and a half of quantum field theory. As always, there should always be some motivation to study something. And for me, studying the second half of the quantum field theory on the spin non-zero part is quite clear. The world is made of some neutrons, protons, and ultimately quarks and electrons, and we see light above us so we can see. And they are all spin not equals zero. So far, we discovered exactly one scalar field, namely the Higgs. But everything else is described by things that have spin either equals 1/2, which has some other names. I think it's just, I don't know how this name comes about, but it's something has a spin. But equals, if it's speed equals to one, we call it gauge bosons or whatever, photons or whatever. So this interesting object has spin in the middle of a scalar and a vector is called a spinner. It's just adding a, turning this thing into another noun. So this studying spinner is a very interesting thing to study because all our world is made of it. And so I'll say the motivation is that we want to study the real world. Although we're going to study some complex object, but it's the real world that I found it a strong motivation to study as I was trained by a particle physicist. Well, the thing is that I will say that the scalar that you have studied for 2 weeks is somewhat simple. You might have a different opinion because you're working on dense homework, but relatively simple. In the sense that spin, like scalar has this really nice property. It has only one component. If it's a real scalar, it has one component, and it's already Lorentz invariant itself. So that you can invoke such technique such as just randomly write a polynomial and it says, this is the interaction. Taylor expansion, we have studied in like first year in college or even high school, somebody knows how to write down a scalar interaction. Well, maybe not calculating it, but for spinner, it's quite a different story. Spinner does have multiple components and it does transform under Lorentz transformation, as that's actually how spin is defined. Spin is defined according to their transformation under Lorentz transformation. And if it doesn't transform, it's called a scalar. And if it transforms in some way, it's a vector. Some other way, it's a spinner. I will focus on spinner for about a week and a half to study this object. And see, so that would be my motivation. But why do people study scalar? Actually, you don't know, right? Before Peter Higgs actually proposed the Higgs particle that actually would solve the problem of the mass of the particles, physicists really study scalar field because, well, they can. It's the simplest thing to study. And hopefully they will learn some very useful lessons from them. So although our next half the course, as in the route to learn quantum field theory, will be slightly harder because these complications, but hopefully we will learn enough lessons from last 2 weeks. When we go back, you will see from the quizzes and from the lecture, I'll keep referencing what we have done in the first 2 weeks so that it will make things somewhat easier. So the overarching goal of this course is basically summarized by your final homework. And you know, if you have taken quantum field theory before, you can probably calculate now. It's called being able to compute compute this matrix square with some caveats for spinners, because you have to do some taking care of of all this spin one half complication, but it's a matrix square, matrix element square nevertheless. And then you want to produce some sigma, the cross section, gamma, the decay rates, and pass it to the experimentalist and for them to find it in the detector. And the homework will only contain this part, and you will only need to compute one part of that part. Of course, especially if you are interestingly pursue future research in particle physics, I'll strongly recommend to compute the whole thing. But for the course, we want to limit it the load, then you will only need to compute a very specific part. And you will have to learn a lot of techniques, namely what we're gonna learn in the next 7 lectures and the 5 tutorials to compute this thing. Or understand what we are computing. So this will be a process in thing called quantum electrodynamics, also known as QED. And of course, the similar technique could expand to into any case you are computing the interaction between scalar, spinner, and a vector. But of course, if you're talking about things fancy as non-abelian gauge theory, you'll have to wait until QFT. But the goal is to being able to calculate a matrix element square to hand off the experimentalist so they can compare with the experiment, as physics is a science to calculate something that can be tested. So you will see that homework in the due time. I could post the ultimate homework right away now. You could calculate if you have seen QFT before. Okay, so the outline of the course, as you have seen the email, but I'll go through it quickly, is that we're gonna spend 3 lectures to study the Dirac equation. And a lot of you guys mentioned it in the quiz already, which describes the spinners. And then we're gonna look at its solutions. You have an equation, you might as well solve it. And then we'll land on the Dirac Lagrangian. So this is, again, why spinners are complicated. So I remember in the scalar part of the course, and then you were just given such a Lagrangian, says, let's compute. And I wouldn't ask any question either if I write down the Lagrangian for the quantum harmonic oscillator, and if I want to upgrade it into a field theory, there's not much room to wiggle, and this is probably what's gonna be written down. But for Dirac Lagrangian, if I just write down the Lagrangian, says, oh, we're gonna start this Lagrangian and compute everything that we need to compute. And then you'll be like, what's this thing? Why it has a bar? What's this D? What's this slash? Like, you'll be like, what is this? So this, what is this thing? Which we'll see tomorrow, where does it come from, is this thing. It looks like a very confusing thing. Like, I wouldn't say, there's some classical mechanics Lagrangian that I could just say, oh, let's try to write a field theory correspondent and somehow land here. And this is another reason why spinner is complicated, and we are not going to do that. We are actually going to take an approach to make the Lagrangian looks natural, looks reasonable. There are actually 2 approaches to do it. And so there is a mathematician approach, more mathematician approach, and there is a physics approach. So the mathematician approach, think of the question this way. They say, okay, we classify particles according to how they transform under Lorentz transformation. And I know there is scalar, I know that there are vectors, since I'm a mathematician, I want to find all possible other representations. And of course, among these all possible other representations, the simplest is the spinner. And Tang's notes follow those approach. And Tiber's notes from a while ago also follow that approach. It's a great approach, and you get to be very confident what you're doing is right. You're searching for all possibilities, and one possibility just stood out in your face and says, look, I'm the possibilities that gave you Dirac equation. And you pick that one, and you continue your journey, write down some Lagrangian study. And we will actually take the physics approach or the historical approach. We'll look at how Dirac get his very famous equation and move on from there. And then we'll spend three lectures, and using one lecture to context the Dirac field. See, although it's a complicated thing, but if we got the fundamentals right, we'll also just use one lecture to quantize it. It's basically the same thing you did with a scalar field, except you quantize the Dirac field. It has a lot of factors tending around, but the basic idea is the same. So then we'll immediately learn about interacting fermions. Okay, sorry, interacting spinners. I gave it away. This thing also has a name called fermions. And we'll also explore that, why is that so? So in that lecture, basically, we'll write down the famous LSC reduction formula for fermions. That's how fermions interact. You have two particles in the beginning, two particles in the end. We try to compute the matrix element there. And then in the next lecture, we'll use the example of Yukawa theory, which is just the scalar spinner interaction. Since we learned the two objects, two fundamentally different all kinds of objects, we should let them interact and see what happens. And in the last two lectures, actually it's the last one lecture and the two tutorials. So the last lecture is basically a tutorial. I'll talk for about 20 minutes at the beginning. So in the last two lectures, we'll quantize Maxwell theory, because it's the best theory. And then study QED and reaching our overarching goal of writing down the matrix element, compute the square for this particular very established theory that is real. It's the theory that really describes the interaction of electrons and photons. So now let's get the first lecture started. I hope you don't have questions about outline, but if you do, please let me know. And if you say, I also want to see so and the same is not mentioned, let me know and I'll try to at least to find some reference and provide you some look into the literature. And if the suggestion makes me very enlightened, I'll include it in the lecture. This is very possible. Last year, a student asked me a question. I was like, oh my god, this question is so important, and so it became a tutorial. So please keep asking me questions. That will improve the quality of the tutorial. Okay. So about the Dirac equation. Okay, so we know that we need to study. So for the first lecture, let me restate. The first lecture, we're going to study the spinner, which is spin 1/2, and which is also a fermion. See, at least three properties of the things we're going to study. And you should really have interrupted me and ask, what is a spinner? Do you mean by spin 1/2? And what is a fermion? What are you talking about? So I'll try to answer those questions today. I think I'll be able to answer what is a spinner, and why do we think it has spin equals 1/2 today? Why it's a fermion, we'll have to wait until we quantize it. So that will be until on Friday. So today, we focus on this. This, we wait until we can quantize it. So I'll give you a really not a very good answer. I'll tell you that the spinner is the solution of Dirac equation. And you should immediately ask, what is Dirac equation? So what is Dirac equation? Okay, so as I said, we're going to take a historical approach. And we'll look at how Dirac finds his equation. Apparently, he found it by staring into a fire and think really hard. True legend. So what Dirac does is that, Dirac find a very unsatisfying status in his years. So that's pre-1929. And then he found his equation, he's very happy. But before that, he's not happy. Because what we have seen in a quantum theory course is that one way to go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics is, say, turn some quantities into operators. And as you have done in the quiz, that this is the recipe given in the quantum theory class, is that you see an energy, you turn it into a time derivative, you see a momentum, you turn it into a spatial derivative. And now, if you have such a energy-momentum relationship, you can just plug it in. And if you call this thing an operator acting on some wave function, you get the very well-known Schrödinger equation. Yeah, this should be familiar to you because you have seen it at least once. Okay, and Dirac says, great. No, not Dirac, but somebody says, great. We'll write down it for, in order to include a relativity, which is a real thing, after we discovered that the speed of light doesn't change. It's a constant in all reference frame. Relativity is a real thing. And if we have any theory want to study real object, we'd better follow the relativity version of the energy momentum relationship, which, as you have seen in the quiz, we're trying to combine these two things together. And the result, so this is what you learned in relativity. And you want to say, oh, let's turn this into a operator. And what the operator is going to be partial derivative with the same index, at least from the Lorentz point of view, it has the correct index, so it must be the correct answer. And you can check component, it actually agree with that one. Like there is a minus sign. I'm so sorry that we have a metric convention, which is the same as dense convention, which is most minus. And then there is, of course, the convention that these gray collector goes from 0 to 3. And there's some ijk. Normally, they denote to the spatial component. They go from 1 to 3. And there are going to be other objects as index. And I'll mention them as they show up. But so far, we use this convention together with the Einstein summation, which means it's a pair of index is always a sum. And together is I have no idea where should I put my h bar and c on the board, so they are all one. So these are the global conventions throughout the course. If there's any new convention show up, I'll let you know. All right, so with this substitution, it's the same thing. You have some E and a P and a whatever, you replace some by operator, and now you say E and a P is actually a 4 vector, we're gonna replace it by a 4 vector operator. So now the only thing I need to do is get this guy in there. So let me write it once, that P squared is P mu, P mu. And this guy should go to I squared, which is minus, actually goes to partial squared. So this is what you have, the majority of you yesterday told me that we'll arrive at the Klein-Gordon equation. So what is Dirac so unhappy about? Dirac is unhappy because in the Schrödinger's quantum mechanics, there's something called the probability density. Which is defined to be psi star psi. And this thing is, since wave function is just a number, so that's by definition positive definite, which makes sense because it's a positive probability density. What do you mean by negative probability to find anything? So then, that's happy. And then yesterday there is such a question on the quiz ask, why don't we just write down the direct implication of that? I should just write down phi star phi. Why not? The question is why not? Right? Why don't I just write down that the same, this is psi star psi, this is phi star phi. Wouldn't that be perfect? Well, it turns out it's very hard to explain why this is a density. Among lots of responses I saw yesterday, I apologize, I can't remember your name. But I remember this response the best, so I'm going to present it. So one of you says, we should prove this by contradiction. So first, let's think about it. What is density? Well, density, by definition, it's a sum of quantity divided by volume. So we should always have this relationship. Some quantity. And then this quantity can give some mass or charge, some quantity. You have some quantity that you can count. And then you divide it by volume, you get density. That's basically how we learn the name of a density from like high school physics. Okay, so this, for example, if it's mass, if you have some mass in a volume, it shouldn't be different. Like if somebody else running by this box have like 5 electrons, carry -5 charge, and somebody running by that box, maybe it looks bigger or smaller. Smaller box, but it still have 5 electrons. This thing is certainly a quantity invariant under Lorentz. This just means that it's the same for all observers. That's what the Lorentz is. It's just there are a bunch of observers doing different things. And a quantity such as how many particles in the box, how many charge, how many mass, those shouldn't really depend on anything. Okay, great. And then let's look at this. Since we just write this down in exactly the same way we write that down, and Klein-Gordon equation, as we know, describe a scalar field, and a scalar field by definition doesn't change. It's invariant and Lorentz. So you have invariant, so this thing also invariant. Oh, okay, this is also invariant. Well, now we have a problem, because we all know volume, which has mass, has dimension, length to the cube, it's definitely changing under Lorentz. So that's a contradiction. We can assume this thing is a density, but then this doesn't hold anymore, because you can't have something invariant times something definitely doesn't change. Definitely change, and then get something not changing. Thank you again for the person who gave me that answer. I really like it. Okay, so I guess this guess is not very good. We should revise. And good that we actually have already done so. We have learned at least twice, once in classical physics, once in quantum field theory one, there is a very famous theorem called the Nernster theorem says that, yeah, this is how we cook up a conserved quantity, and the time component will be density. And you have seen this. I'm not going to derive it, because Dan has done it in his first lecture. You can, if you forgot where this comes from, you can read up on that lecture. You find a symmetry, says phi goes to e to the I alpha phi, and then says, oh, this is a symmetry of the Lagrangian, because if there's a symmetry, I must be able to find a conserved current or conserved charge, and if you follow the recipe, you end up. Okay, so now, the only thing we need to do is take the time component and call it our density. So this is exactly the same thing, except I replace mu by zero. And now we have another quiz problem. It says that I propose that I have a plane wave, which we all have learned. The plane wave is indeed the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation that says, why don't we plug this in and see what happens? Okay, so I'm sure you have done it. But what you did is the phi star is then e to the ikx, and I need to take a time derivative. So I pick up ik0, and the exponential will go away. And then I get something like this. And if I do it for both terms, I pick up a factor of 2. So the result of this calculation is this, which is not good, at least for Dirac. Well, Dan has already explained why this is okay, because you can identify this as charge. But for Dirac, this is the worst, because this thing is only positive definite if you have this condition. And then of course, the plane wave doesn't care. Plane wave can have all sorts of k0s. So Dirac says, oh no, I have a probability density that is not positive definitely anymore. So he is very grumpy, and he really wants this thing to be still positive definite. And by carefully examining the Schrödinger equation and the Klein-Gordon equation, he concludes there is a problem. Where, like, for him, this is the problem. And he tried to figure out where the problem comes from. And by carefully examining, where is my equation? This equation. And this equation. And he says, oh, this must be why. So here's a question for you. Why do you think, what's the difference between these two equations such that one of them has positive definite density but the other one don't? What is the crucial difference? You can also carefully examine how the density is written down as.
Time derivatives.
Thank you. There's two time derivatives and there's only one. And apparently the extra time derivative gets to pass on to the density. That's why we have positive, non-positive definite. Thank you. Thank you. So two time derivative is the problem. Dirac concludes. And Dirac says, I'm determined to fix this. So let's try to step in Dirac's shoes, which is very big shoes, but let's try to guess what he wants. Well, it seems he wants one time derivative. What would be the second thing that he could be possibly want in the same line of one time derivative? How many spatial derivative can he want? He wants a relativistic theory. One, because that's what we learn in relativity. They must be on the same footing. We can't be having a theory has distinguishable time and space, and if we do, well, we have the Schrödinger equation, which is not a relativist. Okay, the last thing, what Dirac wants, is also understandable. Dirac says, well, I don't like Klein-Gordon equation, but I do like the idea that p squared equals m squared. If I write down the equation, even if it has only one time derivative and one spatial derivative, but it turns out it doesn't satisfy the relativistic energy momentum relationship, then it's probably not good. So ultimately, Dirac wants his solution also satisfy Klein-Gordon. So this is what a spinner is. Maybe Dirac picked the notation, but we'll stick with it. Spinner says, I have an equation called the Dirac equation, but in addition to the Dirac equation, it had better also satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, because that's how we can be sure that it has the correct energy momentum condition. So those are the three things that Dirac has in mind. So let's follow his step and write down an equation. Dirac says, I want basically all the derivative, all of them, 0, 1, 2, 3, can't be distinguished. And then basically, well, there's only one thing he can do, pick a linear combination of them. And then he look at the other, the Klein-Gordon equation says, well, I'd better have a mass term. That's just a convention. All this minus sign lie, it's just a convention. But if you just look at the first two lines, that's probably what you're going to come up with. And he says, great, I call the solution psi, and act on it and equal zero. This is my equation. And this is also the equation what everybody who has saw his equation remember it as. But of course, we only use the condition 1 and 2. Now condition 3 comes in and says, how could I be so sure that the psi actually satisfy Klein-Gordon equation? Well, so here is approach. Basically, we want to factorize this, and hopefully one factor is this, and one factor is something else. So what we wanted is a sum operator O. This is so not colorful. Okay, we want the operator O that are acting on Dirac equation, and then it will reproduce the Klein-Gordon equation. So let's just pretend everything is fine, nothing is operator, I'm just doing normal numbers. Then what I see this thing is a number. And I want to factorize this number. As you learned in complex numbers, if I want to really mimic that thing and write Dirac's operator like this, the other term had better to be the complex conjugate. So this is just how I factorize the number. And now we're just going to close our eyes and hope this works for the operator too. And see where we at. We land, right? So I guess I make a bold guess as this operator, this blue operator, is the complex conjugate, but not really. But it's just consider this thing is a number, and then we complex. Actually, consider this thing is a real number somehow, and then do the complex conjugation, and hope this works. Well, it, of course, it doesn't work always. If it doesn't work always, we're just close. We're just going to stop here. Says, oh, any linear combination is going to be fine because we can always find its operator. If they are just numbers, if this whole thing is just real number, and then this would directly give us the Klein-Gordon equation due to this factorization. But of course, because all this, who knows what's this linear coefficients, so there is all this partial, it might not work out. So let's do a better check. Well, this factorization at least gave us one nice thing, is all the both cross terms cancel, and they definitely gave us the mass term. So the only thing I need to vary is the first term, and then we vary if this going thing going to be equals partial square. And if I can somehow make that happen, I'm done. So, oh, there's partial derivatives. As you have seen relativity a lot of times, if you see two partial derivatives, you should be immediately excited. They are symmetric. I must be able to do something good about it. In our case, if we say something symmetric, we're just going to also symmetric the other piece because the anti-symmetric part is going to drop out. And I can write out carefully what exactly is partial square, which is that. And now I happily just cancel the partial squares. What I'm end up with is this. And it turns out this is very common. So now we're introducing a notation. Not sure if it's new, but we're going to introduce something called anti-commutator, which means instead of minus sign, we have a plus sign. But it's very easy to notice why do we introduce this. Let's say it was some writing. The more index I write, the more mistakes I'll make. Okay. So we realize, okay, well, I'm not really surprised if any linear coefficient is going to work. That would be a crazily powered equation. It just it doesn't make sense. There should be some constraint on these things. You can't just have like arbitrary numbers in your equation of motion. That just doesn't like work with the intuition of all these equations I've heard in my life. Okay, so let's look at this thing a little bit. What it tells me is gamma zero.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
How'd you get from that step where there's gamma nu tel mu, gamma mu tel mu?
This step?
Yeah.
So these are some numbers. So they don't contain any dependence on the space-time. So the derivative wouldn't act on them. So I just switch them. And the next step, I'm saying that I know I have gamma nu, gamma mu, but it was multiplied by something symmetric. So I'm only going to take the symmetric part of gamma nu, gamma mu. Since the anti-symmetric part times the symmetric part is going to give me zero anyway. So I only need the symmetric part. So this equation makes sense. That on the left side, it's symmetric. On the right side, it's also symmetric. Okay, so let's just kind of stare at this thing and wonder, let's put a box around it. Okay, I'll box this guy too. So together, this guy and this guy, which is the condition on these gammas. So then if you look at this, it seems to tell me that and that. So if you just take nu equals zero, you get plus one. You take mu equals nu equals I, you get a minus. Yeah, is that clear? Okay, well, this is kind of crazy, right? There are three things, squared to be minus one, and then we also have a bunch of other equations. It's just not gonna work if they're numbers. So this is when we conclude, interesting. This gammas, we thought it's some linear coefficients. Well, they are coefficients still, but they are matrix coefficients. Has to be matrix just because for numbers, we just can't solve it. So let's yet introduce another convention. So it's whenever I write AB as index, or ABCD, I guess, these kind of thing. They are spinner index. They run through some numbers, we'll find out. But now let's just remember the gammas are matrix. So if the gammas are matrix, then this equation need to be somewhat modified. Because, let me write down the new insight coming from trying to figure out what is this gamma thing. So this is not a good equation. There is some matrix, subtract some number, multiply up some function. It just doesn't work. So secretly, the mass is multiplied by an identity matrix, and Psi actually have a spinner index. So, as I said at the very beginning, this spinner thing, it has more than one component. If you want to know, we'll stick with four. I'll explain sort of later. But the thing is that there can't be one component, it's at least two or more. And then there's a standard procedure to figure out exactly how many minimum components your spinner needs to have. But now, I sort of answered my question. The question I want to ask is, what is a spinner? And now I can say, spinner is the solution of the Dirac equation. It looks like this. But these gammas needs to satisfy this relationship. They can't just be numbers. Yeah? And I'm sorry, but conventionally, nobody ever really want to write down the spinner index. So as the course progress, more likely, this is what I'm going to write up. Keeping track of all the spinner index just make everything look more complicated. So you're going to gradually get used to the fact whenever you see a gamma, it's a matrix. Whenever you see a psi, it has a spinner index. It's just never written out. It's not quite my choice. I like that choice. But it's just collectively all the people who has written things in, written things on the subject who had decided to drop the spinner index. So unfortunately, this is still not the end. So I would like to give you a break, but let's finish the last little bit and we'll have our break. Okay? The last little break, last little bit about, because it's still about the Dirac equation. So actually, yes.
Sorry, that anti-commutation relation.
Yeah.
Will there be like spinner indices? If yes.
Yes. Mean? Yes, you are absolutely right. So this is actually a matrix. This is also a matrix. And this, I'll put this here to make sure it's a matrix. No, you are absolutely right. Like you should be carrying all this matrix, all this spinner index all the time, but nobody does. So gamma mu is a, there's four kinds of gamma. There's like 0, 1, 2, 3. And then each of them is a matrix. And since we're on this, this is a very useful convention. But it doesn't agree what normally is defined this way. So this is a definition. The definition is you can use metric to lower and raise index of a gamma matrix, but they are still just a bunch of numbers. This gamma is a bunch of numbers. It's not a vector. It's just, normally we write is, it is as gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. But it's a, each of them is a bunch of numbers. So it's not a vector. Because it doesn't transform. It's still numbers. That's just a definition because it makes our life much easier. You can put a gamma index whenever you want. All right. So the last little bit is that I keep trying to say that, oh, this is how Dirac discovered his equation, but you have been lied to. It's a small lie, but I apologize. What did Dirac actually try to do is what he want is this thing, which makes sense, right? This is what it looks like, the Schrodinger equation, except that he has only one, on this side, you will see that he has only one spatial derivative. But it's really not that far from what we have. Well, I guess, okay. One line motivation. We want to find a Hamiltonian, right? It's a very good motivation if we study any theory. We want to know what's the Hamiltonian. Okay, now I'll do the following derivation. Says that, look at the Dirac equation, and I'm just going to separate the time component and space component because I want to compare with this triggered equation thing, the Hamiltonian thing. And the next term is minus n. And this equals 0. Yeah? This step should be simple. I'm just write one term in terms of two terms. And now the next thing to do, of course, is say, I only want the time derivative on one side and move whatever is left to the other side. And we're almost there. It says, I only want the time derivative. What is this thing? As we notice, gamma zero square has this nice property to be one, matrix one. So the next step, we're just going to multiply everything by gamma zero from left. If you think about it, this is a vector equation. Psi is a vector, like in the sense of a vector space. So this is a vector equation, and if I want to multiply a matrix, I should only multiply a vector equation. If I want to multiply a matrix, it should always coming from the left. From the right, just doesn't make sense. Okay, so that explained why gamma zero squared disappeared. That gives me nicely whatever is on the left side for psi. And let's see. I'm just multiplying the gamma zero through. And this thing, it doesn't have the best look, I would say. But this thing is the Hamiltonian. And later on, we will see this Hamiltonian again once we know the Lagrangian of, if when we know the Lagrangian, and we can find the Hamiltonian, and you will see that, yeah, it still looks like that. It doesn't look intuitive yet, but once you have done your homework, the short homework that is due in like 48 hours, you would know why this Hamiltonian makes sense. Sorry, the homework's hand out tomorrow. When I finish, you have until Friday 9 o'clock.
So it's simultaneous with dance? Simultaneous with.
Yep. Wait, when is dance due?
Friday.
I'll talk to him. I'll shift his to Monday. Ours kind of shift. On Friday morning, I have to use it. You have to get it done before then, so we have in the lecture, so I don't have to do it. Okay, I'll talk to Dan about if we can move his homework. Mine can't move. Mine is stuck between when you have enough knowledge to do the calculation and when the knowledge is done. when the calculation is used. There's no way I can move it. All right, stick with me for a couple minutes. We'll have a break. Okay, we're almost done. So he has his Hamiltonian, and we'll leave it for a while. And tomorrow in the tutorial, we'll look at the Hamiltonian for some time. But here is a exercise. It's a very short exercise. You don't have to do it. It's in the note. In the notes. As you can see, the notes are very long, but all the derivations are included. So the idea is once you box the thing says, ha, you are Hamiltonian, but then you shouldn't be that confident. Because there are some requirements about a Hamiltonian we should respect. What do we respect about a Hamiltonian? What do we know about Hamiltonian? Some property. Hamiltonian is observable. If it's observable, then the corresponding operator should be? Excellent. So the exercise size, we need H to be self-adjoint Hermitian. Then you come up with some constraint on these gammas. And this is the exercise that I welcome you to check. All to look at how I checked it. But the idea is, we're not done yet with all the Dirac equations. It still come with another constraint says when you look for all this gamma matrix, it should also satisfy this condition. Otherwise, our Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. So actually, when you are asked, what is Dirac equation? Writing down this equation is not good enough. We have to explain what happens to gamma. And they have some Dirac algebra. It's just what this thing is called. And in addition, it has this thing. And then, of course, Dirac says, okay, sure. Let's take yet another plane wave. Right? And Dirac says, I'm going to calculate the energy. It's given by the I partial derivative g, right? And then he gets k0. He was like, wait a second. But what if k0 is negative? I have all the negative energy states. He's unhappy again. But quickly, he's happy. Because when he write down all these things, he actually considered only starting electrons. It's not that I can tell if I can read his thoughts. His paper is literally called Quantum Theory of the Electrons. So then he says, hey, electrons are fermions. And he has this genius idea, says, oh, our universe has this thing called the Dirac C. If all the negative states are all filled up because they are fermions, they have nowhere to go, so they have to be positive energy. So he says that's why that we don't know this negative state, the energy states. They are not a problem. They are just states that are already previously filled. And then he thinks further. What if one of the states is like a knock out of the C? And then he has this most brilliant explanation ever. He says, now you have a hole in the C that has exactly, it just really behaves like an electron, except it has all the things opposite. So he found the positron. It was found in the cloud chamber or something in 1932. Okay, so now you may have a break. But I have a random silly question that you can think about in the break. So this is a story Tibra told me. I think it's really cute. It says that Schrödinger and Heisenberg and Bohr like went to fish together. They are good fishing buddies. And then they fish some fishes, and then they have a total number of some fishes. And then Schrödinger wake up at night because of thundering, and he says, oh, I'm not going to stay here, it's too cold. He separated the fish into three piles and realized, okay, this is not even, it's not a multiple of three, so he threw a fish into the sea. And then he divided up three fish, the fish, whatever, however there is, and he separated three piles. He says, okay, I'll take my share, I'll leave. And then later, Heisenberg will wake up. He has no idea what Schrödinger does, but he has the same thought. He was like, too cold, I'm going home. And then he did that thing, exactly the same thing again. He threw a fish into the sea and separated into three pieces and take his share and leave. And so does Bohr. Like, he has no idea the two people already left. But he says, I'll be fair and I'll make it fair that everybody has three share and he took one share back. The interesting thing is, when they go back home, they realize that they have equal number of fish. Now the question comes, where are they fishing? I'll see you in 5 minutes. So suppose they caught a fish. Then one fish got thrown away. The first guy took away a third of it. And then now somebody else threw it away and end up getting a multiple of three. And we happen to know that this is the last condition, says the second person gets the same fish as the first person. Right? You only need this once. OK, then you put them all together. You get n equals minus 2. So if you start with minus 2 fish, and you throw one fish away, so you have minus 3 fish, so everybody can take minus 1 fish away. and then you're back to the minus two. It's like a loop, right?
Nice.
Ah, so apparently they're fishing in a Dirac Sea. Where else can you find a minus fish? Okay, well, let's start with the real part of the lecture. So solution is on the board. All right, so I've been trying to tell you that we're trying to get a Dirac equation, and it says, no, 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 it's not okay, you just write down Dirac equation, you have to tell me what are these gammas, and how do we find these gammas. Then you find two equations of these gammas, and then yet again I said, we're not done yet. Because to ultimately write down a relativistic quantum field theory for electrons. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. Are the gamma matrices complex?
They can be complex.
Okay.
They're just a bunch of numbers that happen to satisfy that Dirac algebra, and they satisfy these. We don't know what they are yet. They are just a bunch of matrices that are constant matrices that satisfy those things. So we will, by the end of this lecture, we'll get to know what they are. But this is a more important issue. If you write down the equation, it says, I'm an equation that is a relativistic quantum field theory. All the things you consider above, which are not very nice, there's a Klein-Gordon equation condition, there's like time and the space are treated the same. They are all very good things, but it's not enough. Because, well, actually, let me ask, well, of course, see, he asked about gamma matrix. We have tons of exercise today. Sorry, today's quiz will be some exercise with gamma matrices. Then you will have be very familiar with them. Especially you'll be using this the Dirac algebra again, again, using that again, again to calculate things. And, but let's put that aside and ask ourselves a very philosophical question. What is Psi? Well, one answer is Psi is a program to put a group of young, talented physicists in a place called Waterloo for a book camp. That is a correct answer. But what is this thing? So what do you mean by what is Psi? Psi is whatever satisfies that equation. Well, remember, I'm not happy. Because all those things we have considered still doesn't convince me this is the correct relativistic equation. Because the only way to test if an equation is relativistic is to see how it transforms under Lorentz transformation. And the correct answer is it shouldn't transform under Lorentz transformation. That's called a correct physics law that is the same for different observers. So what we do is say, if we have a Lorentz transformation, as you are familiar with, that we are seeking a transformation of this Psi into something, this is just a name. And for this time, I'll write down the index. Says, because it has lots of components, right? So it has to transform with some matrix. With an unknown matrix, such that if it transforms this way, hopefully this Dirac equation is Lorentz invariant. And by that, I literally means if I copy down this equation, but with x prime psi prime, there's also x prime hidden here, this is also a correct equation. So that's what we mean by writing down a relativistic equation. So then we'll do I'll invite you to do a small exercise. I'll see what happens in the lecture notes. But it takes three-step says first to write psi in terms of psi prime, and then we plug it over here. And the second step is to add S lambda here, which doesn't do anything, just stick one more in here. And then the third step is to write a partial mu in terms of partial mu prime. Okay, do three things. We modify three things in the original Dirac equation. We take psi as the inverse transformation. The lambda is just stands for the whatever Lorentz transformation you pick. And then you put S lambda in front so that the second term will look the same. And then we have to write the partial nu in terms of the partial nu prime. After you do these three things, you will compare these two equations. And for the time's sake, I'll just write down the result. It takes two lines. But what you get is this thing. Not a super enlightening. Call it a triangle equation. So basically, it says, if I want to look for the transformation of the psi to make Dirac equation invariant, this S lambda must satisfy this equation. If I can solve S lambda in terms of whatever, then I will know how psi transform, which is also an important information to give when you have a Dirac equation. How does the spinner transform? It transforms with this S lambda that satisfies. Yeah?
What is the thing that is in the parentheses on the right-hand side?
Sorry. I'm silly. I'm trying to call it a triangle equation. Okay, equation number one. It's a reference equation. It's a reference equation I might use later. So I'm so sorry. Maybe we'll not do this. Okay, we get an equation, and then of course the next thing to do is try to solve it. It's not very easy, but you have done almost all of you tell me how to solve this equation actually, because you said I can always relate a group member using the exponential to the generator. And let me be specific with this, is that there is the index. They are all transformation on the spinner. The generator is also transformation on the spinner. And these are just labels. Okay, why these labels? I'll try it. You can see a slightly more serious discussion in notes. But my best shot is to use what you tell me in the quiz says that there are six Lorentz generators. There are three rotation and three boost. And if you think about it, this happens to us before. In classical mechanics, you have three electric field, you have three magnetic field, and they somehow become this F mu nu thing. A rank two, anti-symmetric tensor in four dimension happen to have six components. So this is really, it's written here. It's an organization. It's really pretty. Otherwise, I have to say epsilon one, generator one, epsilon two, generator two. If things are anti-symmetric and it's tensor, then it's much easier to organize things and do more calculation with. So that's why people don't write epsilon 1 j s 1 plus epsilon 2 s 2, blah, blah, blah. So this is just how we organize it. And of course, you can look at the notes to check why these parameters of a Lorentz group is anti-symmetric. This one is not too hard. it says you have this Lorentz transformation, and then you can expand it to find the infinitesimal one. And then the only thing you need to do is the definition of the Lorentz transformation, which is length is the same. That's the definition of Lorentz transformation. It doesn't change length. And if you go through this, you'll realize this thing is antisymmetric. And of course, it makes sense to pair the antisymmetric parameters with antisymmetric generators. So that's all there is. And then, of course, that's the next step is probably the step you don't really want to do. But you know, if you are enthusiastic about this, you can certainly read uptown. And the next thing is, of course, to do a small expansion. It's not a complicated. It's you just write this as 1 plus the normal epsilon expansion, and then you stick to this equation. And with the sum calculation, you realize you can manipulate your result to be this. So this is another exercise you can do. More exercise. It's expanding both sides, and finding all this epsilon, and it cancels them out, and that's where we are. There's no point for me to do it on board. If I do it on board, I probably can't do it correctly. Okay, so we are going to do a very sneak move. The sneak move is that precisely that we know this thing is antisymmetric. And also from this thing we get, if you just stare at it, it seems has something to do with gamma, which also makes sense, right? Gamma is the thing Spinner introduced us. It makes sense, maybe the Lorentz transformation of the spinner also has something to do with gamma. So what can I write down with gamma, and it's antisymmetric and it has 2 indexes?
What's the question?
The question is, I have gamma as my ingredients. Using gamma as ingredients, how can I write down something that has 2 indexes and they are antisymmetric? You can use more than 1 gamma.
The
see, I have some gammas. What should I do?
The
anti-commutator is something epsilon, but you can also use the commutator, right? Something commutator is always a antisymmetric 2 things. So you don't really have to do any calculation. You conclude this must be the case. I want an antisymmetric 2 index things. And the commutator is always antisymmetric. Okay, so this will be the, for interested reader, you can check the coefficient is a quarter. So if you just plug it as back in, you will figure out a quarter is what the proportional constant it is. So now we finally were done with a Dirac equation. A Dirac equation is an equation like that with bunch of gamma, and the way how we determine gamma is such and such, and now is the final piece of the puzzle. Says that in addition, the spinner needs to transform in the following way. We answer that question by providing all the generators. So now we're done. Now if we give a spinner, we have some commutator, We plug it in. We know that the Hall spinner transform. Yeah. All right. The final thing. I promise that I'll tell you why this thing has spin one half. We'll do the real calculation later. We'll do it on Friday. Now we're just going to do a heuristic argument that David gave you. Yep.
So that S alpha beta.
Yeah. It's.
On top with the coefficient.
Yep.
So that S alpha beta is the same.
It's the same as alpha nu. I can just change it.
Okay. And final equations that A and B are spinner indices?
They are spinner index, which we don't know what they are yet. I'm actually going to tell you right now what's A and B. Oh, yep. They have, like, so mu nu run through 0 to 4, 0 to 3. So there are six of them. And each of them has a spinner index A and B. Each of them, each of the generator is a matrix. It's the same size matrix as gamma. And now we're actually going to compute one. So you would know exactly what kind of matrix are. So the one I propose to compute, which is the one you have already done in the tutorial, is this matrix. Yeah, if I write like this, you can recognize it. It's just the cosine theta sine theta minus sine theta cosine theta to the first order. So this is a small rotation in xy plane. And now we're going to take a look at it when there's such a small rotation Lorentz transformation, what happens to my spinner? So the Davis heuristic argument in relativity is that a spin x object after turning around 2 pi over x will come back to itself, right? So since I claim this thing is spin equals half, I'd better show this thing after turning 4 pi to come back to itself. But that doesn't really help me because like anything could turn 4 pi will come back to itself. So the correct way of interpreting this thing, you say let's rotate 2 pi. And I say, does it come back with a minus sign? This is one of the many, many crucial minus signs we'll encounter in this part of course. Whenever you have fermions, spin equals 1/2, we have some minus signs. But it's clear. If it rotate 2 pi, it'll pick up a minus sign. Rotate another 2 pi, pick up another minus sign. That shows that this thing has spin 1/2 because it takes 4 pi to come back to itself. That's what we're going to do. So to do that, of course, I need to calculate S12. And I'm finally running into trouble because I need some gamma matrix. So Weil is a guy. He has lots of good contribution. One of them is to find a set of gamma matrices. And this is the set he found. So sigmas are polymatrices. I'm not going to write down what are polymatrices. They're polymatrices. Okay, so this is a set. So this is called the Weil basis. As you can say, polymatrix has two dimensions, so this thing is a 4x4 matrix. So all the gamma matrix we are going to use are 4x4 matrices. This 4 happened to be coincidental with our space dimension 4. You can read the appendix, which is really an enriching of the lecture, to figure out why that's true. But if we had a way living in a 6th dimension, it wouldn't be the case. So this is completely coincidental. So the AB actually also run from 1 to 4. It just happened to be 4 is the correct answer because this is the lowest dimension we can find this gamma matrix is satisfying Dirac algebra. Okay, so the thing we're going to do is calculate S12. So S12 equals 1 quarter gamma 1 gamma 2, which is the commutator. And if you think about it, because the anti-commute relationship, you just get a 1 half gamma 1 gamma 2. And the gamma 1 gamma 2 is polymatrices. So there is two steps, two more steps skipped, but you can calculate this thing and realize this is the result. You multiply sigma 1, sigma 2 together, you get a sigma 3, and then there's an I pop out. Let me just double check. Right. Okay, good. So some small steps. You are certainly welcome to check. So then you just have to exponential it with 2 pi. So now we have e to the 1 half I sigma 3 is just 1 minus 1. And now I need to multiply by this by 2 pi, which I'll put it here. So this is the rotation, since I'm writing exponential. So 2 pi is not a small angle, I can use it nevertheless. So this is what that this thing gave me. It says calculator generator combined with the parameter, I can write down a S lambda. And then of course you, because of the very famous Euler equation, you have e to the I pi everywhere. So this thing give you minus 1 acting on spinner. So indeed, if you somehow rotate 2 pi, I skip some steps, and it's less rigorous, but you can read the notes about it. But that's the basic idea, is that I calculate the transformation matrix, which is defined there. I calculate using my generator, plug in some gamma matrix, calculate the generator, multiply by the parameter, and then I get a minus 1.
Is it a specific result due to the choice of the whale basis?
No.
Or is it true for everyone?
Oh, yes. So wait, so this result, minus 1 is not. Whatever happened inside is. The final result is independent of the basis. That's a good question. But of course, if I pick something else, hopefully it's just going to be have an even more complicated looking matrix, but hopefully the exponential give you minus 1 because this is an intrinsic property of the spinner that shouldn't depend on the choice of the basis. Okay, so I'll end with a thing that I claim this calculation is kind of, not a well basis. Look at this thing. This thing is called a fidget spinner. So according to this definition, this thing has a spin 3. So we got to have some better way to calculate, actually calculate spin is equals 1 half, which we will do. Once we have a one particle state, we'll measure the spin, and the h bar over 2 pops out, and we'll have. So tomorrow we'll talk about Dirac spinner's cousins, which are known as the Weyl and the Mariana spinners. And then tomorrow at the end, we'll write down the Dirac law.